Welcome to Thursday's edition of Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Melody is taking care of other business. For all your precious metal needs, call us toll-free at 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. For the next hour, I'll be bringing you some opinions and commentary on the economic and political news of the day. It's Thursday, August 5th, 2021. Hello, America, and hola, mundo. Thanks in advance to our producer and engineer, Todd. Let's get started with today's market report. Now, in the precious metals market, it's been a week of what seems to be two steps up and one step back in the New York spot aftermarket. Gold is now, well, it just switched on me. Bear with me a second here. Gold is down $7, close at close to $18.06 an ounce. Silver down 23 cents right now at 25.25. Platinum also down close 2%, 19 bucks at $1,008. And palladium, the only major precious metal, up barely $2, $2,736. Now, gold, finished down after an early morning rise today, but on a stagnant day, really, where after the generally positive jobless claims report, it just couldn't hold on. But all eyes are on tomorrow's Department of Labor, Bureau of Labor Statistics jobs report. Good news, it's above 1,800 as it goes into the end of another week. Now, let's see. In the oil markets, domestic West Texas crude up about just shy of a dollar. It's $69.10 a barrel. International Brent up 87 cents. Close at 71.25. In the crypto currencies, since it's on a lot of people's mind these days, Bitcoin up $41,045. You got Ether. Let's see, which one do we want to look at? We're going to look at Ethereum, the coin, U.S. dollar coin metrics up at 2,807. And the ever interesting Dogecoin, that's actually down very slightly, essentially steady at, what is that? Is that 20 cents? Yeah, that's 0.2. That would be 20 cents. Moving on to treasuries, all major maturities up a little bit today. The bellwether 10-year yield up 0.04, close at 1.224%. The 5-year up 0.49, it's close at 0.723%. And the long-term 30-year note up 0.023, close at 1.864%. And in, let's see, what happened to my, let's just jump to dollar index that, where are we here? That's moving around. That was actually closed, unchanged, at 92.27. very little movement in that today. And then in the paper markets, internationally, Chinese and most other international markets down today, except for the Nikkei in Japan. In the U.S., Dow Jones up 271 plus points to close at 35,064. The broader S&P 500 up 26 and change to close at 4,429. And the tech-heavy NASDAQ up 114, close at 14,895. And ladies and gentlemen, that is today's DGS Market Report, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Now, another Thursday means another Labor Department jobless claims report. Initial claims for unemployment benefit edged lower again last week, while longer-term unemployment showed continuing signs of some improvement. First-time filings for benefits dipped to 385,000 for the week ending July 31st. It's a decline of 14,000 from the previous week, as the job market remains essentially in a holding pattern. The total hit economist estimates exactly, which is rare. The four-week moving average of claims, which smooths the weekly volatility, was little changed at 394,000. Now, claims have circled largely in a range around 400,000 since mid-May, with employment rising in leisure and hospitality, but changing very little in other key sectors, most of them goods-related industries. However, continuing claims showed a sharp decline, plunging by 366,000 to a little more than 2.9 million. That's the first time continuing claims have fallen below 3 mil since mid-March, in fact, last year. The slide in continuing claims comes as the total of those receiving unemployment benefits under all federal and state programs fell to just below 13 million. That's a reduction of almost 200,000, mainly due to a drop in those receiving extended federal benefits. A year ago, that number was just shy of 32, as federal enhanced unemployment benefits were directed to those displaced by the widespread business lockdowns. Now, the weekly claims numbers come just a day ahead of the closely watched July non-farm payroll report, which will be out first thing tomorrow morning. While economist estimates for the BLS report is about 845,000, yesterday's report from ADP showed just 330,000 more private payroll jobs, which could signal a disappointment in tomorrow's numbers. Now, last week's jobless claims numbers will not figure into the non-farm payroll count in the morning. Now, a related story about 7.5 million workers who've relied on pandemic unemployment benefits will be cut off from jobless aid altogether when they expire on September 6th. As of mid-July, 9.4 million people were drawing benefits from pandemic unemployment assistance, which again covers those not traditionally eligible for aid, such as freelancers and the so-called gig workers. It also covers pandemic unemployment emergency compensation, that so-called PUEC, which extends aid to those who've exhausted their state's benefit periods, which by and large is 26 weeks. A couple of them are less, and I think as low as 12 weeks. Workers drawing from either of these programs make up for almost three-quarters of Americans collecting unemployment insurance. The programs which support people who'd normally fall through the cracks of the unemployment system were established by the CARES Act last March and were extended until Labor Day this year through the American Rescue Plan. When pandemic unemployment was last extended in March, it kept an estimated 11.5 million from falling off the so-called benefits cliff. And while pandemic unemployment programs officially run until early September, governors in 26 states withdrew early in June and July. Those moves left 1.6 million workers without jobless aid over the last month. It's not noted how many of that 1.6 have returned to either their old jobs or new ones. Now, critics of pandemic aid have said generous benefits, including the $600 weekly supplement that dropped to $300 a week last summer, have kept people from accepting new jobs that would jumpstart the economy further than it has. Many employers, particularly in leisure and hospitality, have been having trouble filling a growing number of opening roles as consumer activity has picked up since the spring. But Census Bureau data suggests that recipients didn't rush to find jobs in states that cut off pandemic aid early. Previous research, in fact, has suggested that financial assistance hasn't kept people from taking jobs as much as the availability of paid work, workers' individual health and safety concerns, and access to child care. Although I believe that some of those who tell the pollsters that the cutoff of or that the pandemic aid wasn't a factor, I think maybe thinking, well, I maybe have to stretch the truth here because I don't want them not considering a further extension, they meaning Congress, although I doubt that's in the cards. Now, in other economic news, the U.S. trade deficit surged almost 7% to $75.7 billion, its largest on record for data going back to 1992. That's for June. Now, a $1.2 billion increase in exports was more than offset by a $6 billion increase in imports, according to the Commerce Department. In June, exports edged up $207.7 billion, while imports surged to $283.4 billion. The totals pushed the year-to-date trade deficit to $136 billion. That's a 46% rise from the same period a year ago when Americans' demand for imports was being dampened by the onslaught of the pandemic. The politically sensitive goods deficit with China rose to $27.8 billion in June. That's up 5.8% from May. So far this year, the goods deficit with China is $158.5 billion, an increase of almost 20% compared to 2020. You know, analysts say the surge in the deficit may start to slow in the coming months as the initial boom in consumer spending from the economy's reopening starts to level off, and increased growth in foreign countries helps to boost U.S. export sales. With the U.S. economy rebounding more quickly than the rest of the world, U.S. demand for imported goods is outstripping a slower increase in foreign countries' appetite for U.S. exports. Now, the widening trade deficit has actually been a drag on the economy this year, as it is most, while the overall economy, as measured by GDP, grew at a rate of 6.5% in the second quarter. The trade deficit subtracted 0.4 of a percentage point from GDP growth. Now, let's see. Sounds like children in the outer offices of the studio. We welcome them to our good vibes. Now, speaking of travel, I mean, Spirit Airlines has canceled nearly 400 more flights. That's half of its Thursday schedule as the airline continues to try to end disruptions that have upset customers since, well, last weekend. The airline blamed a combination of bad weather, staffing shortages, and technology problems for their disruptions, which has led to more than 1,700 flight cancellations since last weekend. Angry and confused passengers complained about long weeks to speak with customer service and of course, long waits getting through security at crowded airports. The issue's testing the low-cost carrier strides made in recent years to improve reliability and its customer service. Spirit said the problem was worsened by the spike in summer travel demand, which bounced back faster than from the pandemic slump than the industry expected and, of course, planned for. Now, by noontime today, Eastern time, about 80% of all U.S. flight cancellations had come from Spirit. American airline passengers also faced snowballing cancellations and delays earlier this week, largely sparked by severe weather at Dallas-Fort Worth on Sunday and subsequent staffing shortages at different parts of the country. But those delays reportedly have been subsided with just 43 cancellations today. Not good news for a struggling industry looking to bounce back, ladies and gentlemen. And speaking of trade, container shipping rates from China to the U.S. have hit fresh highs, over $20,000 per 40-foot box. That comes as rising retail orders ahead of the peak U.S. shopping season are adding further strain to global supply chains. Typhoons off China's busy southern coast in late July and this week have also contributed to the crisis, gripping the world's most important method for moving everything from gym equipment and furniture to car parts and electronics. Phil Damis of the maritime consulting firm Drewry said, these factors have turned global container shipping into a highly disrupted seller's market, where companies are charging 4 to 10 times the normal price to move cargoes. And he added that we haven't seen this in shipping for more than 30 years, adding that he expected these extreme rates to last until the Chinese New Year 2022. Spot price per container on the China-U.S. East Coast route, one of the world's busiest container lanes, has climbed over 500%. From just a year ago to just shy of $21,000. And that compares to just under $11,000, a little more than a week ago. Of course, the surging container rates have fed through to higher charter rates for container vessels, which is for shipping firms to prioritize service on the most lucrative of routes. Oh, that's it for this segment. We're going to head into a short break. Please stay tuned to these important messages, and we'll be back. You're listening to Financial Survival. We will find you acting on your best behavior. Turn your back on Mother Nature. Everybody wants to rule.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. On the web at DGScoins.com, DGScoins.com, and on Facebook at DGScoins, at DGScoins. And, of course, toll-free at 800-375-4188. I'm Dave Allen. It's time for our weekly segment, Levity is Golden. This week's topic is personal sacrifice, although some might call it the proverbial cutting off your nose to spite your face. We know Americans like working from home, but so much so that over half of those who participated in a new nationwide survey said they'd be willing to take a pay cut to continue doing so. An online survey commissioned by insurance company Breeze found that two-thirds, almost 65% of American workers who said their jobs could be done entirely remotely were willing to take a 5% pay cut to continue working from home. Most workers said they wouldn't shave off more than 5%, but some did go further. Almost a quarter said they would take up to a 15% cut, and 15% said they'd take a 25% cut to remain remote. 46% said they'd give up a quarter of their paid days off, and 15% said they'd sacrifice all of their time off to be able to work from home forever. Now, companies across the country continue to grapple with how or whether to lure their employees back to the office. Most respondents to this survey said they'd work an extra 10 hours a week, and 39% said they'd give up health insurance benefits. Another 36% said they'd give up their 401k or other retirement plan, again, to work entirely from home. John Simmons, who's an executive at Inbox Alley, told Breeze that his company hit an obstacle when it tried to order workers back to the office. He said, "We noticed that returning to the office would be an issue with almost half of our staff when we sent out an email asking them to return to the office. One person was even willing to quit and offered to stay on as a freelancer. So as a compromise, we now have one day a week where everyone's required to come to the office, and that day is mainly for meetings. 4 days of the week, people get to choose if they want to come to the office or work from home." Ladies and gentlemen, we live in interesting times, don't we? And that is this week's Levity is Golden. All right, now almost the opposite of levity. Vice Chair, Richard Clarida, says the Fed's likely to hit its economic targets by the end of next year and start raising interest rates again in 2023. While Clarida said the jobs market still has to recover, he noted that inflation is tracking to meet and exceed the Fed's 2% goal. Well, there's an understatement, ladies and gentlemen. applying the more comprehensive methods used by the government in the 80s and 90s, inflation is actually between 9 and 14%. Well, in any event, even at about 5.5%, Clarida says that sets the stage for the Fed to hit the substantial further progress benchmark it set before it says it will start to tighten policy again. Clarida said, quoting, "As long as inflation expect expectations remain well anchored above the 2% goal. Commencing policy normalization in 2023 would be entirely consistent with our new flexible average inflation targeting framework. Rita, however, gave no timetable for when the Fed might start tapering its monthly asset purchases. It's been buying $120 billion a month, $80 in Treasury securities, another $40 in mortgage-backed bonds to keep financial markets liquid amid the pandemic. While Clarita noted that his colleagues in here discussing when they might pull back on the bond purchases, he only said that the public will be given plenty of notice before a decision is made. Now, this speech to the elite Peterson Institute comes amid growing concern over a peak in the economic rebound that the government inexplicably began in April of last year. At least that's what it said. The recession started and ended, as well as a surge in inflation that has taken price increases well beyond the Fed's target. Clarita noted that the core personal consumption expenditure index, that's the Fed preferred inflation metric, are running at a 2.7% rate since February of 2020, just before the pandemic hit. Should his and their expectations for inflation ahead materialize, then Clarita believes that necessary conditions for raising the target range for the Fed funds rate will have been met by the end of this year. Current market pricing has shifted in terms of rate expectations among investors, with future contracts tied to the Fed's benchmark now indicating just a 44% of a chance of a hike by the end of this year. That's according to the CME Group. However, market sentiment around the Fed is even more volatile than usual, and Clarita's comments, particularly around inflation, indicate to some that a move could come sooner. Under a framework adopted last year, the Fed said it will tolerate a moderate run of inflation above 2% in the interest of reaching a full and inclusive goal regarding employment. Ah, yes, employment. Boy, you'd almost think that was an afterthought among these Fedsters. Now, what kind of investor would ignore economics? Well, a successful one, according to hedge fund manager Howard Marks, anyway. Nearly all investors, large and small, retail or institutional, rich or striving to be rich, have views on the economy and how it works and where it's headed. Many of them, like billionaire Ray Dalio, go to great lengths to disseminate and popularize those views, but that's all marketing, not investing. One of Mark's investing tenets hold that economic forecasting isn't critical to investing, not critical at all. He says, I can count on one hand the investors I know who successfully base their decision on macro forecasts. Marx asked the only question that matters. If you invest on the basis of your macro views, how often have they helped? There are two common answers to that question. The first, which is typical among individual investors like you and me, is very rarely. Investors tend to overestimate future inflation in developed markets and underestimate the likelihood of a major negative shock in emerging markets. Institutional investors, on the other hand, if they're honest, will tend to say that they too don't invest on the basis of their macro views. But look, a huge part of being an institutional investor is sales and marketing, persuading individuals that you're smart and you're a safe place for them to put their money. Because stocks do well when the economy does well and do badly when the economy does badly, those individuals will invariably ask about your economic outlook. So those investors need an answer to that question. Once they become adept at answering those questions, they end up being asked those questions more frequently. And while the answers don't help in terms of investment returns, Marx thinks they often help convey an aura of general expertise that in turn helps to retain and increase total funds under management. The bottom line, there's no utility in listening to investors when they're in economic pundit mode. There's also no utility in trying to use economic forecasts to make money. Almost no one can do that. Well, here at Discount Gold and Silver Trading, we try to bring you our views on the news of the day. That includes various economic forecasts and estimates. We don't like to market gold and silver to our listeners per se. Rather, we believe the news itself and our views about it show you why investing an adequate amount of your portfolio in gold and silver is good for your long-term financial security. We've been providing that for 25 years. Call us at 800-375-4188. We'll try to provide it to you, too. Now, a widely followed metric suggests that stocks have been getting cheaper over the past year, even as prices have surged to new highs. Now, if that surprises you, well, it surprised me, too, till I took a deeper dive. Now, when market caps balloon, it's tempting to think that the stocks must eventually fall in order to get to more reasonable levels. However, this isn't necessarily the case when earnings prospects are improving. Perhaps the most popular measure of value in the stock markets is the forward price earnings, or PE ratio. Simply put, it's the market value of a company divided by what it's projected to earn over the next 12 months. When the ratio is above some long-term average, say 1, 5, or 10 years, the stock is thought to be expensive. If it's below average, well, then it's cheap. The S&P 500's forward PE touched a high of 23.6 late August last year. On that day, the 28th, the S&P closed at 3508. Since then, the forward PE has actually trended lower, registering at 21.2 as of July 30th this year. During that period, the S&P surged 25% to 4395. Now, this interesting dynamic and counterintuitive to a large extent has largely been driven by several consecutive months of improving expectations for earnings this year, mainly above the analysts, the Wall Street and other market analysts. And during the current earnings season, most companies have proved that analyst forecasts for earnings continue to be too conservative. These unusually conservative expectations for earnings can be tracked to early 2020 and how analysts reacted to the pandemic. Lizanne Saunders, who's the chief investment strategist at Charles Schwab, says during the worst part of the pandemic, analysts were basically flying blind. What they ended up doing in that environment was they erred on the side of, well, just slashing estimates. But companies went on to report better than expected earnings quarter after quarter, and now after quarter. Still, analysts have maintained conservative forecasts, which Saunders says kept the forward PE artificially high. But even at a forward PE of 21.2, that's still about 31% above the 10-year average of 16.2. Saunders, for one, cautions against putting too much weight into long-term historical averages like this 10-year figure, as the macroeconomic environment has significantly evolved since the Great Recession. She notes that the historically low interest rates we have today support higher valuations. Also, an increasing share of the S&P consists of high-growth tech companies, which come with higher valuations. Thus, she concludes that an elevated PE ratio alone is not a reason to think stocks are doomed to fail. Anastasia Amoroso, who's chief investment strategist at iCapital Network, thinks it's typical in a quickly recovering economy to see earnings get revised higher and beat consensus, leading to same or even lower multiples. When accounting for these higher earnings, she added, the true multiples may not be as expensive as they seem. The point is with these folks is that there are other metrics that should make investors think twice staying heavily leveraged in stocks. I think stock buybacks are one good reason, which artificially inflate a stock's price and a company's worth. More importantly, though, is corporate debt, now pegged at somewhere between 64 and 85 trillion. That debt is what's poised to bring on a major correction, if not crash, at any time. Now, in the remaining time we have in this segment, we're reading that the Biden administration has approved its first arms sale to the island democracy of Taiwan. It's a potential $750 million deal, and it comes amid, of course, rising tensions with China, who says Taiwan is a part of the mother mainland. The deal calls for selling Taiwan 40 new self-propelled howitzers and almost 1,700 kits to convert projectiles into more precise GPS-guided munitions. The proposed sale must go through a congressional review process and then through negotiations between Taiwan and UK-based contractor BAE Systems. BAE is also providing the U.S. Army with the latest version of their howitzer before a contract is signed and delivery times are hashed out. Of course, the Chinese Foreign Ministry denounced the sale and said that Beijing would take countermeasures based on the development of the situation. China imposed unspecific sanctions on the defense unit of Boeing, Lockheed Martin, and Raytheon last year after the U.S. approved weapons sales to Taiwan from those companies. Taiwan's presidential office actually thanked the U.S., saying the weapons would give Taiwan more confidence to ensure peace, especially now with more flyovers of airplanes, including bombers from mainland China. China sees Taiwan as part of its territory and hasn't ruled out the use of force in pursuit of unification. China's President Xi Jinping called his country's quest to gain control of Taiwan a historic mission. Well, what we have coming up is a not-so-historic break, but we hope you'll stay tuned in any event to Financial Survival. We'll be back after these few important messages.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CommonSenseVoicesOfIntegrity.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
One more time, welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. We're at 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. While you're on the website, sign up for our free weekly American Survival newsletter, which comes out on Mondays. And you sign up today, you'll get our weekly blog, What a Rush of Gold and Silver, which will come out sometime tomorrow, come out weekly on Fridays. Wow, Israel, back in the news. It's escalating its response to rocket attacks this week by launching rare airstrikes on Lebanon today. The Israeli army said that its jets struck the launch sites from which rockets had been fired over the previous day, as well as an additional target used to attack Israel in the past. Israel blamed Lebanon for the shelling and warned against further attempts to harm Israeli civilians and Israel's sovereignty. The overnight airstrikes in southern Lebanon were a marked escalation at a politically sensitive time. Israel's new eight-party governing coalition is trying to keep the peace under a fragile ceasefire that ended the 11-day conflict with Hamas's militant rulers in Gaza back in May. Several incidents leading up to this week's rocket fire from Lebanon have focused attention on Israel's northern border, and the U.S. swiftly condemned the attacks on Israel. The strikes also come as Lebanon is mired in multiple crises, including a devastating economic crisis and political deadlock that's left the country without a functional government for a full year now. Lebanese President Michael Aoun said Israel's use of its air force to target Lebanese villages is the first of its kind since 2006 and indicates the presence of aggressive escalatory intentions against the country. He said Lebanon would submit a complaint to the UN. Now, Israel and Lebanese militant group Hezbollah fought a devastating months-long war in 2006, which killed 1,200 Lebanese, mostly civilians, plus around 160 Israelis, mostly soldiers. That war failed to neutralize the group's rocket threat, and Israeli officials say Hezbollah's improved missile arsenal is now capable of striking virtually anywhere inside the country. No one has claimed responsibility for the rocket fire from Lebanon, and Hezbollah has not commented as it usually does. Now, the Hezbollah-owned Al Manar TV reported the Israeli strikes around 2 a.m. local time today, saying they hit an empty area in my Mudaya village in the Marjeon district. Israel's army Arabic language spokesperson said the Lebanese government is responsible for what happens on its territories and warned against more attacks. The same region, Iranian cleric Ibrahim Raisi has been sworn in as the Islamic Republic's new president against the backdrop of challenging negotiations with the West on the revival of its nuclear deal, as well as domestic unrest, a ramp up in local nuclear development, and accusation of sabotage in Gulf waters. Earlier this week, as we reported, Raisi, who has long been vocally anti-Western and is under U.S. sanctions, in fact, for human rights abuses, was given the final approval for the presidency by Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Raisi was elected in June, quote-unquote, in a vote many Iranians and Western advocacy groups say was rigged. The approval from Khamenei followed fresh maritime conflicts in the Gulf waters between Iran and more than one of its Arab neighbors. A Japanese-owned and Israeli-operated commercial tanker was hit by multiple drone strikes in international waters off the Omani coast over the weekend. And the U.S., U.K., and Israel have all blamed Iran for that. Two people aboard the ship, a Romanian national and a British national, were killed. Of course, Tehran denies involvement, as it does with a separate seizure this week of a tanker taken off the coast of the UAE. Again, Iranian officials deny any role in that, although the vessel was ordered to sail to Iran. Washington is reportedly preparing another round of economic sanctions in response to the latest attack, but a more dynamic response also remains on the table, whether that means some kind of military action. I guess we'll see. Now, for his part, Raisi is seen as a more hardline and anti-Western figure than his predecessor, Hassan Rouhani, who oversaw the signing of the 2015 Iranian nuclear deal, formerly called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPA. The deal signed by several world powers, including the U.S., lifted sanctions on Iran in exchange for curbs to its nuclear program. The U.S. unilaterally withdrew in 2018, at the same time reimposed sweeping sanctions on Iran that have crippled its economy. Now, this comes as Tehran increases its uranium stockpiles and enrichment in gradual breaches of the 2015 accord, which it says is only in response to the U.S. sanctions. Iran announced in late May that it was enriching uranium at 60% purity, a dramatic departure from the 3.7 level permitted under the JCPOA. Following the news, the International Atomic Energy Agency Director Rafael Grossi sounded the alarm, saying a country enriching 60% is a very serious thing. Only countries making bombs are reaching this level, end quote. Now, 60% is known as virtually weapons grade. Commercial enrichment is 2, maybe 3%. Iranian officials contend that the enrichment is their country's sovereign right and that their nuclear activity remains for peaceful purposes. Joe Biden has signed an order blocking the forced removal of many Hong Kong residents from the U.S. for a period of 18 months. That gives them a temporary safe haven from the ongoing repression by China in that region. Biden's presidential order will allow Hong Kong residents whose U.S. visas are expired or which will expire and who are otherwise legally removable to remain here. Biden also directed the Homeland Security Department to move to allow Hong Kong residents who are subject to the order to work legally in the U.S. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said, given the politically motivated arrests and trials, which we talked about in this program last week, the silencing of the media and the diminishing space for elections and democratic opposition, we will continue to take steps in support of the people in Hong Kong. The memorandum signed by Biden imposing the order also says China has undermined the enjoyment of rights and freedoms in the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region, including ones protected under the so-called Basic Law and the Sino-British Joint Declaration. since June 2020, when China unilaterally imposed its national security law on Hong Kong. Police in the semi-autonomous region have taken into custody at least 100 opposition politicians, activists, and protesters on largely, if not totally, bogus charges under that law. Police have also arrested more than 10,000 people in connection with anti-government protests. The crackdown by China comes in response to anti-government protests that began in Hong Kong back in 2019. Now, the presidential memo also said the United States is committed to a foreign policy that unites our democratic values with our foreign policy goals, which is centered on the defense of democracy and promotion of human rights everywhere in the world, offering safe haven for Hong Kong residents who have been deprived of their guaranteed freedoms there, furthers U.S. interests in that region. Now, Biden's order applies to Hong Kong residents who are currently in the U.S. with certain exceptions, which include people who are inadmissible to the U.S. or who are deportable under immigration laws, as well as those who have been convicted of a felony or certain multiple misdemeanors here in the U.S., and those whose presence is deemed not to be in the interest of the United States. Now, speaking of international conflict, when it comes to reining in presidential war powers, Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri agrees with President Joe Biden, and they don't agree on many things. Hawley supports repealing a decades-old law authorizing the use of military force in Iraq, which has been invoked as part of the legal justification for other military strikes elsewhere since then. They've also become the initial focus of a broader effort to re-examine how much leeway Congress should give presidents to wage war. Hawley said it's time to kill this. Speaking of the law passed in 2002 to authorize the invasion of Iraq under President George W. Bush, as the senator's stance and those of others reflect a tentative but notable shift underway among Republicans as the U.S. disengages from what critics called the forever wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and continues to debate how to battle terrorist groups, especially in the Middle East and Africa. After espousing mostly hawkish interventionist positions for decades and almost uniformly backing the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, the Republican Party is now grappling with political pressure to align itself more closely with the inward America First doctrine articulated by Donald Trump and backed by many of its voters. It parallels similar foreign policy shifts Republicans have made in recent years to inch closer to Trump's views, including a move away from their support of free trade and a growing appetite for aggressive federal intervention to bolster American competitiveness against countries, mainly China. Many Republicans remain opposed to repealing the Iraq-related authorization, and they've shown little enthusiasm for getting rid of the much broader war authorization passed by Congress after September 11th. Still, the shifting policies of the issue have helped fuel the first significant bipartisan effort in a generation, really, to curb the president's authority to take military action. Legislation taking shape in the Senate to repeal both a 1991 authorization for the Persian Gulf War and the 2002 law, an effort blessed by Biden, partly symbolic, given that the government says it's not relying on either of them. But it does reflect a growing consensus to reassert Congress's influence over matters of war and peace, driven at least in part by the changing Republican political calculus. The House, with support from dozens of Republicans, passed two bills in June this year repealing the Iraq measures. And yesterday, a Senate committee approved legislation to repeal both laws, with Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer confirming he would bring it up on the floor at the Senate for a vote later this year. And that debate would be the first time in years for lawmakers to weigh in on an attempt to claw back presidential war-making powers that could actually be signed into law. It could also fuel further discussion about more consequential questions of what to do about the post-9/11 authorization, which both Republicans and Democratic presidents have repeatedly invoked since 2001 as the legal backbone for U.S. military force and action around the world. The Biden administration has said it's open to tightening the law, but there's little consensus in Congress about how to do that. The issue of presidential war powers has long divided both parties, stoking mostly a theoretical debate. But the dilemma this year is particularly acute for Republicans, for whom it has become the latest in a series of proxy battles over Donald Trump's hold on the party. And that's pitting those who want to follow the former president's lead in getting the U.S. out of conflicts in the Middle East against those who favor longstanding party orthodoxy in favor of muscular military posture. We'll see where that takes us. Mitch McConnell, he's one of the most vocal exceptions. He condemned recently the efforts to appeal the 2002 authorization of military force. So nothing's a done deal these days, ladies and gentlemen. But one thing that is a done deal, the end of today's program. I'll be back next Tuesday. Melody, I'll be here tomorrow with Butch. Also be on the lookout again for our blog and your team blog after the sunrise. I'm Dave Allen. Appreciate you listening. Have a good evening, and please be safe out there. Bye-bye.